Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast, where we speak to forestry leaders and innovators who are shaping the future of forestry. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Lauren Carson. He's the president of Carson Integrated. Lauren, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good stuff. Good stuff. And where are we reaching you today?
Today, I'm in Slave Lake, Alberta.
Slave Lake. Okay. I was thinking you would be in Edmonton, Alberta somewhere, but you're actually like moving around as a true forester on the road, right? So
our main office is in Edmonton. We work all over Northern Alberta. And so today I'm in Slave Lake.
Nice.
Friday I'll be in Fort McMurray, and between here and there, I have to get to Edmonton to go to the Oilers game tonight.
So. That's right. Big game. Game one of the Stanley Cup. So for our global listeners, this is like the ultimate of the ultimate championship, where two hockey teams, guys with sticks on ice, are going to battle it out. So that's very cool. I was actually initially thinking you were going to say, hey, Friday, I'm going to be in Arizona doing a round of 18 golfs, getting some nice weather. But I guess it's a busy time. You're laughing. So I'm sure there's people laughing on the call as well. Good one, Kevin. It's like, that's not the life. And given the season where we are. So thanks for joining. Looking at your LinkedIn profile, I actually chuckled because Carson Integrated has been around for quite a long time. And ironically, you graduated by the looks of it from the University of New Brunswick in forestry in around 99 timeframe. So we're probably around the same vintage is probably the best way of saying it. But maybe start us off in terms of telling us, how did you I assume you grew up out in Eastern Canada. Maybe share with us your journey and how you got into forestry.
Yeah, I grew up on a Navy base in Dartmouth. My father was in the Navy, and so that's where I was. And it was a good life growing up on the base. Every family that's there has to have at least two kids if you're going to live on the base. And so there was tons of kids around, all kinds of fun all the time. And then, you know what? I don't think it was until about grade 12 that I actually started thinking a little bit about the future. It was kind of just by accident. I had a couple of buddies. One was going off to Coast Guard College and one was going to Dalhousie to take engineering. And they were asking me what I was doing. And I had never thought of it. At the time, I was working part-time at Canadian Tire while going to school. And I thought when I graduated, I would just go full-time to Canadian Tire. And then they made me think about it. And so as I got thinking over the next few months, I actually went out and interviewed people in different disciplines that I was interested in. So there was geology, forestry, and environmental science. And I really liked the forester. His life sounded mostly like what I wanted as my life. And so I applied to University of New Brunswick to the forestry program and got in. And I really enjoyed my time there. It's a really good program. And in my fourth year, I went over to Sweden and did a semester in Sweden in an international silviculture program. Which was really, really fun as well. I met people from all around the world there. And when I graduated in 99, I moved to Slave Lake, Alberta, and I've been bouncing around Alberta ever since. So
I was going to say, I saw that where like literally you graduated and then went out west. So was that by design? I think you started off with Vanderbilt Contractors.
Yeah.
By design, or was it more just... given the state of forestry out in New Brunswick, there weren't as many opportunities or the story there.
Yeah, there weren't very many opportunities anywhere in Canada at the time. Like our graduating class, it was a big class. It was close to 100 people. And I think only about 5 people got permanent, like full-time jobs.
Wow.
And then I had a contract. It was a 5-month contract I had. And there was a few other people that had contracts, and a lot of people couldn't find forestry jobs. It was probably a year or two, and then the government of Ontario went on a hiring spree and just kind of vacuumed up everybody from across Canada that were in the forestry discipline and that weren't working. And
wow.
Yeah,
that's amazing, because you contrast that with where we are today, where when you talk with people, they can't find enough foresters to do the work. So I guess that's roughly 20 years difference in time span there. So so this is great. I'm going to add to my checklist as I speak with people. The the digital forester journey? Did you work at Canadian Tire at some point in your life and launch from that? And for those listeners from abroad, Canadian Tire is a big retail store that does anything from like automobile parts to your feng shui curtains. It's a big store. So you went out west, so very, very, very cool. And you went the entrepreneur route, and we'll dig into that because you don't just own one company, you own several companies. So we'll poke into that a little bit more. But was there an entrepreneurial spirit? You said you grew up on the base. Was mom and dad kind of go-getters
No.
there? Or where did that aspect come from? And was there any fear of starting that? Because thinking today with a lot of the young workforce, right, employment rates are very, very low and they're struggling to get in. So I'm just wondering if maybe, your experience maybe a couple decades ago might translate to today for some of our younger listeners looking to figure out what they can do while they're being challenged in finding gainful employment.
Yeah, I didn't have anybody else in my family that was really entrepreneurial. But I did know at a young age. I remember, I think it was grade 8 or 9, I was doing a project in school and I decided to do it on entrepreneurship. And it was right then at that age that I knew at some point in time I was going to own my own business. And I didn't know what or when, obviously, or that type of thing. So I knew, and then when I moved to Alberta, it took me a few years to kind of get my feet under myself, learn, the geography, meet the people, learn all, the rules, regulations, all that type of thing. But I always knew that at some point I was going to have my own company. And then I had been at Vanderbilt for about 7 years, and it's a small company and it's family owned and it's a really nice family. They're great people and we still work with them and I know still know the family. And but I just knew that there really wasn't any long-term challenges there for myself. And so I decided that, I think the timing is right, and talked to my wife and we decided, you know what, let's just do this. And so I did.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. So maybe walk us through that journey early on. What was life like? So it's the Carson group of companies. So there's various pieces, but maybe introduce us to the portfolio of maybe active companies now, and then later on we'll touch on some of the initiatives that you launched and dig in to understand thinking and what worked and what didn't. But maybe introduce us to the Carson family.
It's changed a lot over the years. Like we've had some successes and we've had some failures. And one thing that I think has been consistent throughout is I've enjoyed it all. Like the failures can be stressful at times, but if you learn from it and just keep on, you just got to keep going.
A
And
true entrepreneur, a true entrepreneur.
but we so I started out thinking I was going to be doing forestry consulting, that type of thing. And so when I started the company, the forest industry actually kind of went in the tank right around then. And there wasn't a lot work. I had enough at that time. It was just myself. So it was, I could keep myself busy. But the oil and gas industry was booming. The electrical utility industry was booming in Alberta. And so I wound up just getting into those industries and taking my forestry skill sets over to those other industries. And, that was quite busy and that kept me busy. And I really wasn't doing any work in the forest industry for close to 10 years because I was just so focused on those other industries. And we still do a lot of work in those industries. But I remember I was out on a power line construction job and I was supervising the harvesting and of the power line right of way and then the building of the road. And one day at the morning meeting, the project manager says, well, we lost our safety guy. Anybody know any safety people that are looking for a job? And that's why I raised my hand because I did. I had a friend that was a safety guy and he was unemployed at the time. So I said, yeah, I do. And he said, okay, we're giving you the safety contract. And so all of a sudden, now I was doing forestry work, but I also had a safety contract. And I mean, I wasn't a safety person, but anyways, I thought, what the heck? And I took it. And the next year they said, you know what, we really liked the job you guys did. We want you to hire safety people for all of our projects. They're like, oh, okay. So the next year we had 6 safety people. And then that at the end of that year, they said, you know what? This year we decided that we're going to integrate our safety and our medic contracts into one. And we'd like you to take it, but only if you're willing to do both. And I said,
Wow.
yeah, sure, let's do this. And so before you knew it, we were a forestry company, we were providing safety, we were providing medics. And then that's when we did spin up a new company at that point, the Safety Matic company. We spun off, and I found a partner who had that expertise.
Wait. So
And
this all started from 0 to 1 to 6 to something bigger, all because one day there's a dude who's like, "We lost our safety guy."
it was, and I
Amazing.
was just the person that raised my hand when he said it. Everybody else that was there just kind of, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. And I raised my hand and said, yeah, I think I can figure that out.
Oh, amazing.
And yeah, before you knew it, we, like within a couple of years, we had medic trucks all over the province of Alberta. We had at one point, we had up to 50 people out as safety or medics people on different power line, pipeline, oil field construction projects. And it was quite busy. And that was one of the businesses that we had some really good success with. And then the price of oil collapsed
Right.
and it fizzled. Like within a year, all the trucks were parked and we had to lay off staff and we sent a bunch of stuff to the auction. And we were, yeah, we had to regroup. So we wound up closing that company down. Another company that we had was, we had a company, a GIS consulting company at one point called Lat 60 Geospatial Solutions. And I had a partner in that as well. But the way that one started was same thing as we were in the forestry side of our business. We were providing, like we were using GIS all the time for all of our services. It's just a standard part of forestry is to be GIS centric. And this other person approached me and, he was quite adamant that there was a demand for a GIS consulting company out there, and I agreed. And so before you knew it, we started up, we spun that off and started up a GIS consulting company as well. And it went for about 5 years, and it was had mediocre success, I would say. We had quite a few clients that were hiring us just for our GIS services, but really what we found is that for me and for our company, GIS services fit in amongst our forestry and our environmental services that we provide. That's where it really fit. And so we wound up wrapping that company up and bringing it back into part of Carson Integrated as part of our core services there. And another company, the one that had the most success, other than Carson Integrated, I suppose, or these two have both had good successes, Stonefish Rentals. And it's an industrial rentals company. We rent out light towers, generators, offices, ATVs, snowmobiles, skid steers, excavators, like all that type of stuff that people need on industrial projects. And my partner there, he started the business with his three brothers, and it was growing a fair amount. And I was a customer of them. Plus, I knew him well already anyway. And his brothers didn't want to continue on in the business after a few years. And so I asked him if, I could work with you and together we'll buy out your brothers and why not? And we did. And it was a real small company. Even at that point in time, there was maybe two employees plus him and I. And yeah, it's grown a lot over the years, and it's a real going concern. And we have a real strong manager there. And yeah, it's so
Oh,
these days, it's mostly our forestry and environmental company, Carson Integrated, and then Stonefish Rentals.
yeah, it
And
makes
those are
sense because I
the.
guess with Carson Integrated, you probably need some of the ATV rentals things. So I assume there's probably some good synergies there where you can piggyback one business off of the other while maintaining both as separate. So very cool. Yeah. So tell me more about Carson Integrated, the maybe the flagship now, I guess, given those experiences. Yeah, what do you do and what are your main customers and what do you see as trends out there in the business?
Yeah, I normally say we're a forestry and environmental consulting company, and we are. We work in the forest industry, oil and gas, sand and gravel, mining, utilities. Really, any industry that operates on Crown land is kind of where we find our sweet spot. Like we often get people ask us to do municipal work and those types of things, and it just doesn't suit us. I think our people are more comfortable when they're way out in the middle of nowhere and that type of thing, and it works well for us. So. But we try to provide a range of services that you really find in any typical woodlands department. So we have civil culture people, we have environmental planners, biologists, foresters, forest planners. We have field staff. We have quite a big field staff. So really anything that you find in a typical woodlands department these days is what we try to provide. And we provide, some customers come to us because they want our silviculture expertise. Other customers come to us for our forest planning expertise. Some come to us because they want our biologists and agrologists to help them, plan out the routing for new roads or a new gravel pit or, those types of things. And so each customer comes for different things. And then our GIS team really supports everything. Plus, we do have some customers that come to us just for our GIS services, but mostly the GIS department supports all the other departments within the company.
Interesting, interesting. And so over the years, like how big is Carson integrated today, and has it been a stepwise growth or maybe more J curve depending, or maybe is it completely dependent on the state of the economy and the industry, the health of the industry?
Yeah, there's been variability. Like we, in the first few years, it was quite rapid growth. And then when we got the safety and medics and that type of stuff, like that was a J curve. That was very quick. And it dropped off very quick as well. So we have had ups and we have had downs. The forestry side, we really started focusing on our forestry and environmental services probably around 2015, 2016. And we decided to start, we got out of the medic business, we got out of the safety side, all those types of things that were just distractions for us is what I realized, and decided to just start focusing on our core disciplines. And my wife and I, we own the company together. I run more the forestry side of things, and she runs more the environmental side of things. And it's been, I would say, since 2015, it's been a kind of a slow, steady climb. And every year we're a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger. And right now we're probably about 45 people all told within the company. So.
Yeah, that's amazing, amazing. So working with your spouse partner, that's got to be interesting on some days, but maybe we'll go there later on in the podcast in case she's listening or eavesdropping. We'll wait till she leaves for the day for a meeting, then we'll go down that side. So very cool. So I wanted to maybe bring you to today's forestry being in Northern Alberta, Western Canada. Can you describe to us what the state of forestry is in Western Canada, depending where you are, whether it's BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, they're all very different stories, I think. So for our listeners and viewers at the global level, what would you tell them, and how would you describe the state of forestry in Western Canada right now? Is it booming? Is there tons of opportunities? Everybody come, young Lawrence, come to Western Canada, or are there some headwinds or whatnot that you're keeping an eye on? What would you say to that question?
I think of it in a long-term approach. And in the long term, I think Western Canada is the land of opportunity. If you're young, smart, ambitious, hardworking, want to take some risks, I would say come to Western Canada. Or come to Canada in general. It's the land of opportunity. In the short term, there are some headwinds for sure. The BC forest industry, I think in particular, has had some challenges over the last few years. And when I talk to clients in BC, like there is some more doom and gloom, I think, over there. And right now, with things happening in the world with Trump and all those types of things, you can tell everybody's kind of a lot more cautious in Alberta and Saskatchewan is now right now as well. But I feel like there's still lots of opportunity in Saskatchewan and Alberta. I think if you're a good company and you're focused on quality and safety and the things that are important to our clients, that there's opportunities still. So.
Yeah, so thinking of BC, maybe if we focus on them for a bit, what would be some of those challenges that you're hearing from your customers that are keeping them up at night and worried?
I think they have a challenging regulatory environment is one thing. It does take a long time to get your harvests approved in BC. I was talking to one fellow there, and he said, it used to be a matter of months to get your AOPs approved, and these days it's upwards of 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah. And so that's quite a challenge. And I think it's been compounded by things like pine beetle and fires and some natural disasters that have put constraints on the harvest levels there as well. And I think just kind of all those things combined have made it a challenging environment. So, and lumber prices aren't strong, and then you got the softwood lumber and those types of things. So,
Yeah, multiple factors adding to the uncertainty. And so when you look to Alberta and maybe Saskatchewan, where do you see the opportunities? And I would agree with you where Alberta, when I think and about my experiences and when I talk with other people, Alberta is very pro-business, where it's maybe more get SHIT done type of mindset, not like let's wait 2 year, 3 years, which is kind of cool, easier to do business there. But what would be some of those opportunities that when you say you think of Alberta and Saskatchewan, what would they be? Because some folks would actually probably be more maybe bullish and say, forget BC, it's like look to Alberta and look to Saskatchewan, some other, or maybe even Eastern Canada. Where do you see opportunity?
I think the opportunity lies what we're trying to focus on is helping our clients become more efficient, do more with less, that type of thing. Use technology to their advantage. There's lots of opportunities in things like machine learning and that type of thing, and using those technologies and skill sets in order to do things better. And so that's where, those types of things are where we're trying to focus. The forest industry itself in Alberta, I think, is kind of like it's not going to get bigger. Like all the wood here is allocated. There's mills. I don't think the market size is going to increase or anything like that. So I think you just have to focus on helping all of our clients get better. And in Saskatchewan, it is a little bit different, in that I think all the wood there is allocated, but there aren't enough mills to utilize all of the allocation that's there. And so I do know the Saskatchewan government is actively trying to court companies to come and build mills or expand mills or those types of things. So I do think the market size will increase there in time. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And when you combine that to your comments earlier, where, maybe uncertainty in the regulatory frameworks, uncertainty with international trade, if the US and other jurisdictions, yeah, I guess that becomes maybe more of an uphill battle when you're seeking capital investment to add this capacity. It's not like it's something that could be built overnight. It takes
Yes.
time. Absolutely. So you mentioned technology. So this is the Digital Forester podcast, and you have been at this long enough. You and I have known each other for several years. Each year we get more gray on the side coming in there. But how would you describe technology from your lens as someone that has been delivering services to the forest industry and other sectors as well? Are there phases maybe of technology evolution, innovation, transformation that stick in your mind that you can describe in discrete time chunks? What's maybe surprised you? What's not surprised you in your 2 decades of running Carson Integrated?
Yeah, there are trends that I see, and some trends that I found were funny. Like I found when I was young in my career, and we were using GPS units, collecting data out in the field, that was fairly new at that time. But we were, all in on it for a few years there, and then kind of that 5 to 10 year space where I was just off in the oil and gas industry and whatnot. When I came back to forestry, I felt like the forest industry actually took a step back with a lot of that stuff. Like they weren't using that type of technology in the field to the same degree that I thought they were previously.
Interesting.
But I've found in the last 10 years again now that it's been gangbusters. Like everybody is trying to just take advantage of the benefits that technology can provide and use that to become more efficient. And there are challenges with it. Like for instance, maybe 5 years ago in our company, we had our storage capacity in our servers was about 5 terabytes. Today we're 130 terabytes and our IT guys telling us we need more. And it's just like never ending. And so And yet I know, so we have that 130 terabytes. I know that all of that data that we have also resides on other people's servers. And, you know, like it's probably three, four, five copies of it in other spots. We just aren't finding ways to all share it. And so we got, you know, three, four, five people all paying for that storage. And some of it could be cloud storage. But I find for those large data sets, it's better to have them on premise. That's what we've always found. So that's one trend is just the amount of data. And then just what do you do with the data? Like we have so much data. It's hard to figure out what to do with it all the time, or even if you have an idea of what you want to do with it, to have the people and the resources to actually make that happen and to have, you know, you have to develop a process. You have to, it's so that's a challenge as well. And so the more of those types of tools that are out there to allow us to synthesize that data into useful information, that's tremendous. And there's that's getting easier and easier all the time. And another trend that I see is just co connectivity. Like right now with all of our field crews, we have a Starlink satellite system with that follows each crew around so that they can sync their data a couple times a day if they need to, or and so that and because we want to have it in back in the office, that and some and allows us to push updates out to them as well. Like we have for instance, when our crews are out laying out a cut block, if they find a stream that wasn't mapped, they can quickly map it, sync their data. The planner sitting in Edmonton can digitally put a buffer on that creek for them, and then they resync, and now they can just buffer that out in the field without spending a couple hours of doing measurements out in the field and whatnot. They can just all just with a couple of syncs back and forth, then so it just becomes easier and easier to do our jobs if we can do that, and it allows us to keep our clients up to date and those types of things as well. So yeah.
Well, I guess thinking of even that example, the olden days, I guess, would be like, oh, let's collect some information, hop back in the truck, drive back to the office, do analysis, drive back out, go do the work, and cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. So definitely, yeah, let's maybe like dig into a couple of those trends. I'm curious, you made the comment, you know, when you came back to the forestry space and looked at it, and you had mentioned that it was almost like they stepped back in time and lack of adoption of some of these technologies that you were seeing kind of take off in other in sectors or verticals. Why do you think that happened during that period?
I think part of it was the forest industry went through some struggles from, I don't know, 2006, 2007 to 2010, 12, something like that. There was a lot of economic headwinds in the forest industry. And in Alberta, at least, anyways, they'd lost a lot of key people to other industries. Like the oil and gas industry was booming. So a lot of the more progressive, innovative people, I feel like, left and went to some of the other industries, the oil and gas, the electrical utilities, that type of thing. So I think that was part of it is the desire to use those types of technologies just left the industry with those people. And I think that was a big part of it. And then it just slowly started coming back. And I think it's the forest industries is leading the way. Again, I feel like the forest industry's at a good spot with technology, and there's a real desire there to continue. So
So maybe brain drained other spaces or parts of the economy there. And then so thinking of where there's more uptake now, and I sense based on I can hear even in the tone of your voice, oh, the loss here, then a sense of excitement of, you know, now there's more uptake and more adoption. What would you attribute that, or what's your thesis around that? Is it around business drivers, people just needing to be more cost effective, efficient, and maybe catching up for that if I want to call it lost decade, or is it people, a younger workforce? Is it the commoditization of technology? You talked about storage, you know, from 5 terabytes to 130 terabytes to, you know, someone's probably listening now saying, oh, Lauren, that's all you got. It's like I've got a
I
bajillion units of storage, right? But what is there something you've seen as president of Carson Integrated, you know, boots on the ground? I know you're active everywhere in the field. You still get your boots dirty. Is there something that you sense or you've seen that's really different than of yesteryears, maybe?
Well, one of the trends that, like, the reason why I think there's a focus on technology more is the forest industry has always been very focused on efficiency and especially around costs and that type of thing. And I think there's leadership in the forest industry that realizes that that using technology can help keep their costs down. One of the other trends that I see that I think is interesting that is around AI and machine learning. And when I do forest audits, which I do a fair amount of across Western Canada, I do a lot of mill tours when I do those. And there's a lot of that technology in the mills already. Like every single log that comes in gets scanned and processed, and they have AI processing them to figure out the, you know, how do they maximize their product output and their value output, that type of thing. It's not as widely adopted in the forest industry yet, or in the woodland side of things yet. But it's getting to be more and more. Like we have clients now that are actively pursuing machine learning projects with us to try to improve their forest inventories, or you know, maybe a watercourse inventory, or identifying seedlings in their plantations, or you know, those types of things. So I do think that that's a trend that's going to continue, and that's going to it's going to take some effort. But you know what? Canada has set up Alberta in particular. Like in Alberta, we have the Alberta Machine Intelligence Institute, which is a world-renowned artificial intelligence institute. The University of Alberta is a world leader when it comes to research on AI and machine learning. And so I think we're well positioned here to take advantage of some of those technologies and to partner with some of those agencies in order to get those competencies into the forest industry to help make things better.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a good point when I think a lot of us don't realize that once you enter that mill, the amount of sophistication and advancement and process automation like at play is crazy cool. Whenever I get a chance to visit a mill, I'm always like, ah, hell yeah. It's like I want to go in and check it out. Then I got to find out where my steel-toe boots are and all of my other PPE, which I rarely use anymore. So that's probably it takes longer to find all that stuff. But I'm curious to know when maybe we think of it going like upstream in that supply chain or value chain. What are your thoughts on why it's taken so long for, as you said, Woodlands to embrace innovation? Is it more because at the mill level, they've always been talking like how many cents per cubic meter or it's tied or it's the cost of investment or innovation's more tangible versus maybe upstream in Woodlands, it's more abstract, but or is it to your point some or research organizations there that may have monopolized research funding that de-incentivizes some of these forestry companies to actually invest in R&D or innovation, or maybe they've delegated or absolved themselves of that responsibility. What do you think about how we change that? How do we get forest industry, or maybe have we squeezed so many pennies in the woodland side that to seek the gains, really, we have to look towards innovation. What would you change, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask to get the engine going faster from a innovation agenda.
I'd like to see each company dedicate a certain amount of their budget each year to innovation, whether it be and to feel free to spend that with contractors and consultants and that type of thing in the forest industry. Like in Alberta or in Western Canada, we have a really good group of forestry consulting companies. We got some real world-class companies here with lots of smart people within them. And I think that there just needs to be more like a consistent effort. Like I'd like to see some companies kind of get together and pool their money and make some long-term commitments to some of the service providers and just say, hey, you know what, for the next 5 years, we're going to spend X amount of dollars a year, and we want you and your staff to focus on that and embrace that there's going to be failures along the way. That is one thing that I find the industry is quite risk adverse, like the woodland side. Like if I'm sitting down with a client and they say, hey, I want to try this new thing, and I say, yeah, okay, I'm down for that and we're going to try it, but just so you know, it might not work. That's almost the end of the conversation. Like, what What? You mean this isn't a slam dunk? This isn't a guarantee? Like, no, we're trying some new things here. Like, this is the way it's gonna go. Like, we're gonna learn some things along the way, but our first crack at it probably isn't going to work. But you know what? Our second crack will be a little better, and then our third crack better yet. And I find that turns people off. And so I guess that's can't be part of my sales pitch anymore. But anyways, so I think that if they embrace the fact that failure is part of winning, then that would be good too. So, but
Ultimately, I often wonder if it just boils down to, business 101 of leadership. Having that champion that's working maybe a longer time span horizon and understands that there's risk and there's no certainty. Or maybe we all just need to adopt things from the shopping channel where we offer a 30-day money back guarantee, which nobody ever claims, or a free shipping return on whatever. I jest, of course, on that topic there. So you've touched a couple of times on the AI machine learning. So what can you share with our listeners, our audience, our viewers, in terms of what some of the problems you're tasked to focus on? Because obviously, as a contractor, you've got boots on the ground, you described doing different types of things, which is really cool. And I agree, having learned more about, Western Canadian contractors, if you're good, it's like you're like a Carson Integrated still around, after, multiple years approaching 2 decades type of thing. You kind of have that brand, right? So people naturally gravitate to the Carsons with their problems. What would you say? Maybe two examples. Can you give an example of a really, really easy one where someone's coming and you're like, duh, it's like we kind of solved it, but happy to help you, versus a really meaty one where you're like, oh, that's one that I need to pull in the brain trust, the Carson team brain trust to problem solve.
I find a common theme in the woodland side is just trying to understand their land base better. Like some of it is like, for instance, water courses. Like there's lots of water course inventories out there, but very few of them that are accurate. And so using machine learning in order to improve the accuracy of water course locations and then the classification of water courses. It's not super easy to do, but it's doable. And you just need you need data, more and more and more data, and but it's doable. Another one that I think is doable is around like seedling identification, like monitoring your plantations. Trying to think one that would be more complicated because we've had sessions. We've been working quite closely with the Alberta Machine Intelligence Institute for the last couple of years. And I would say the one that probably hasn't been solved yet ties back to like log profile inventories and those types of things. Like a lot of companies want to know. Matter of fact, I sat down with a company yesterday that was just talking about their frustration with the volume estimates that they get from everybody in their woodland supply chain, from companies out doing block layout to their own staff out visiting blocks or estimating volumes at roadside and those types of things. And they've been putting a tremendous amount of time and energy into it over the years, trying new things, and they just can't get a level of accuracy that the mill is happy with. And it's not, I mean, if we could even just get, we have this much volume of conifer versus this much volume of deciduous, that would be a good start. But if you could get it, if you could get a log profile for them, like this is the amount of wood that's going to go to the plywood mill versus the amount of wood that's going to go to the sawmill versus the amount going to go to the pulp mill, that would be better. By species would be even better yet. And I just find we haven't cracked that one yet. I don't think anybody has. There's a lot of people trying and making really good progress on it, but it's a complicated one, so.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. And I wonder maybe to, connect the dots with some of your earlier comments. Is this an example where, having more data, pooling resources, both financial data and people brain trust would be beneficial
Yes.
province wide? Everyone's running into that same issue. So yeah, that's definitely an interesting one. So I'm going to maybe pivot the conversation a little bit, because I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on. Not necessarily, I was going to say climate, not necessarily climate, the topic itself, but maybe some of the outcomes, if you will, essentially wildfires. They're raging right now in Saskatchewan. I think there's some in Alberta, but I think you got some rain. So, that hopefully will help. But certainly over the last couple of years, as we think about some of the work you have to do, forestry, you're in the field, you're planning, whether it's something as simple as, collecting some field plots, the wildfires can change that whole business line planning on the spot, on the dime. So what are your views on what you're seeing from a climate point of view, and maybe thinking of wildfires, and what's your strategy as someone who has to maybe live by the weather gods and their feelings? How do you adjust your business there? So maybe to start, what are your thoughts? What are you seeing on the ground in terms of extreme weather events, fire, precipitation, hail, other types of things, and how does that impact your business?
Yeah, it impacts us quite a lot every year. When fire season comes, like everybody in the forest industry, us, industry, government, like they just watch for fires. Like it's just a, you can't get out of it. You're just nonstop thinking about where's the next fire or how big is that fire going to get and what's the weather doing and wanna. But it used to be that you would watch that, but you might have, a 20 or 30,000 hectare fire and that would be big and that would be all the talk of the town. Now, like that fire in Saskatchewan, I think yesterday was 400,000 hectares. We had one in Alberta a few years ago that was over 1 million hectares, and it's a real thing. Like it impacts industry in a big way, and that their timber supply isn't safe, and so that's an impact on everybody that works in the industry. But at a smaller scale, like we get chased out of areas these days. Like our field crews are out working in an area. And a fire starts up and we get chased out. Like even last week, we were working in an area. The fire was about 20 kilometers away, which, maybe 10, 15 years ago, if a fire was 20 kilometers away, it wouldn't, you might watch it, but it wouldn't really be on your radar. Well, last week we were laying out blocks. The fire was 20 kilometers away. We demobbed our crew because it was the end of the shift anyway. The very next day, that fire burnt over the work that they were doing.
Wow.
Like it
Wow.
just spread that fast, like 20 kilometers in a day, and that's not unusual these days. So it's from a safety perspective, like it's hard to know what to do. Like and so we just have to constantly keep like we have apps in our phones now where we track all of our crews and we track the location of fires and that type of thing, so that we could try to be proactive and pull crews out before they get in trouble. And so far it's always worked. But you know what, I it wasn't that long ago that really wasn't a big thing. When a fire was 20 kilometers away, it was 20 kilometers away. Like you didn't expect to see it.
So the intensity of those fires and the rate of spread. And as a business owner, I'm sure that is top of mind safety of your people, because the last thing you would want to would be to have a crisis on your hand. So in some respects, I guess maybe that previous company that was focused on the health and safety medical side, maybe there's a reincarnation coming at some point. Find those pieces of iron in the trucks and refurbish them and get them going. So do you see things getting better, I guess? And we're focused on fire mostly because that's what we're seeing there, right? And whether people want to go down the route of climate related or not, immaterial, as opposed to the last 3 years, 4 years. Like, to your point, one of the things when I chat with people overseas, they're like, yeah, they hear about our wildfires, right? But I think you described it perfectly, where, when it's 400,000 hectares or 1 million hectares, like the scale of this, like, I don't think a lot of folks really appreciate, like, in their minds, oh, maybe a 5,000 hectare fire, or a 1,000 hectare. Then when they hear 400,000 or 1 million, it's like holy crap, it's like that's more land based than some companies actually have under their mandate or management. So do you see things getting better as the years come, or do you see things getting worse? And if it's the latter, what do you think needs to be done or focused on to make sure that there's a viable industry and people are kept safe and so on.
Yeah, I think it's likely going to continue the trend that it's on. The one thing that I think that we need to do, like, has to be our top priority is protecting our communities. Like, I'm in Slave Lake today. It was in 2011, May of 2011. Slave Lake burned over. Like we lost a third of the houses in Slave Lake, and that's a big impact on a community. Like it takes probably 10, 15 years to come back from that, like just rebuild and that type of thing. Look at Jasper last year, Fort McMurray. There's communities this week that are being evacuated and houses are burning in right across Western Canada. So I think that's got to be top priority is protecting our communities. And that's not going to be easy. Like a lot of our communities are right in the forest, and we have over mature forests right up to the doorsteps of a lot of our communities. And I know the government's making tremendous effort on that and the industry is supporting them, and that's good to see. I'm glad. But I think it's going to take a lot more resources than what any of us are expecting. So and then the forest industry as well, like their allowable cuts are in jeopardy. They're going down like almost every year. There's adjustments being made to reduce their allowable cuts because of the impacts of wildfires. And it makes it hard for the industry to justify investments. Like, do you want to, practice enhanced forest management, stand density management, those types of things in order to get your stands growing back quickly to maybe mitigate some of the impacts of these AAC reductions? And then those stands are going to burn on you, perhaps. So it's a difficult to justify those extra investments.
Absolutely, absolutely. So based on that, I guess, you probably need more engagement within industry, across industry, with government, across governments to figure out a path forward. And I know people are working on that. The certainly my comments are not, people are doing nothing. It's just a really complex problem of how do you
It is.
move things forward, right, in a meaningful way. But I like how you framed it in the sense of, like basics 101, like protect at the very least the communities here, do what you need to do to make sure that from a socioeconomic point of view, we're not impacting families that rely on these communities for their livelihoods and day-to-day lives. And so thinking as we go forward and in the vein of the Digital Forester podcast, I always like to get people I talk to stretch their thinking, their visioning to like 10 years out. What does Carson Integrated look like 10 years out? What does the business of forestry look like 10 years out? What does technology look like 10 years out? Sometimes I ask people to think of it, like what keeps you up at night and looking out 10 years. But maybe since we talked about the doom and gloom of wildfires and all that, maybe we'll shift the conversation to what are you looking forward to 10 years out? Is there's what aspects of the business, technology, whatever dimension excites you? What are you looking forward to?
Yeah, the thing that excites me the most is just working with people. And like I really enjoy the team that we have. We have really good clients, that type of thing. So I don't think that piece is ever going to change, or at least I hope it doesn't. Like those personal interactions and relationships, I think, are important. But there's lots of things that, like, we have some guys in our field crews right now that are trying out, I'm not going to get it exactly right, but exoskeletons. Like to help them walk quicker and further in the woods without getting tired. And
Interesting.
so that's really neat. Like that's a neat piece of technology. And I'm wondering like what's gonna happen with that is
Where did that come from? Let's pause there. I'm curious. I haven't heard about this before. Not that I should hear about everything, but where did the idea come from? What was the spark? And what are we doing? And what are you hoping, or the guys hoping the outcomes would be?
Well, I think it came up like we have an innovation team within our company, and we include everybody from within the different areas of the company, including our field crews on the innovation team. And that was one of the things that the field crew brought up is like, and I think it was because we have a lot of injuries on our field crew from they're overtired, slips, trips, falls, those types of things. And for a lot of our work in the forest industry, we get paid production. And so the guys are always trying to find ways to get more production. And I don't remember exactly where it came from, but all of a sudden some people are emailing a video around the company. Hey, you guys see this? Did you guys see this? And it's these like an exoskeleton. It goes around your waist and then down your legs, and it's battery operated, and it just helps you walk without getting tired. And particularly if you're going like a lot of uphills, that type of thing. And one of our guys asked, hey, do you mind if I buy one of these? And we said, yeah, sure, give it a try.
And these things are not cheap, I'm assuming.
No, they're, I think it was around $3,000 for this first one. And so there, we have a guy out on our crew right now who's trying it out. I don't know if they're going to really embrace it or what, but anyways, they're trying it. And you know what? But honestly, it's $3,000. If that got them, our layout crew, if that got them a few hundred extra lineal meters a day of production over the course of a year, that would be a good investment. Like it would, like I'd be happy. But you know what? So that's trying to help the guys more physically on the field. But where I also see it going is where we won't be going to the field. We'll be using augmented reality and like the Apple goggles that you can, like if we get enough good LiDAR imagery, that type of stuff, I think we'll be able to recreate our world. And you could do a lot of your field tasks sitting in the office. Just put your goggles on and go for a walk around the forest while you're sitting in your office. And that's probably a ways away still, but I can see that. Like it's going to happen. Maybe not at a large industrial scale, like somebody that's got a 4 or 5 million hectare FMA, but you know what? At a smaller scale, I could see it.
When you say you think it's a ways away, do you think it's from the readiness of the industry, the workforce to embrace it, or do you think it's more of a technology thing, or is the technology already in place in there? What do you think is the barrier to that? Because in some jurisdictions, New Zealand, they've done that and shown that you can do some really neat things and maybe get the accuracy and precision where it needs to be. But when you say it's a ways off, what barriers do you see adopting that?
I think it's people. I know within our company, as we talk about it, there's some people that say, yeah, no, we're never going to allow that. No, we cannot do our field work from the office. Like you have to physically go there and get your feet wet and get some dirt under your nails and that type of stuff. Otherwise, you're not doing your job. And so that's a part of it. I think the technology is there. I don't know if the data is there, like that we have enough high resolution data at an industrial scale to do it. But I don't think it's that far off. Like we have a company woodlot, 480 acres, and we make a point of flying it every year to get new imagery, new LiDAR. So this year we got 0.5 centimeter imagery of the whole thing, 300 points per square meter LiDAR, and we actually just bought new satellite hyperspectral 23 band hyperspectral satellite imagery for it as well. And now we don't know exactly all the things that we can do with this different data sets yet, and we have multiple years of those different data sets as well. But you know what? We're tinkering with it right now. We're trying to figure out what we can do, and then if we can figure out how to do something on 480 acres, maybe then we can blow that up to an FMA or that type of thing.
Yeah,
So.
absolutely. Absolutely. Well, hopefully there's a nice camp there in the 400 acres with like a hot tub sauna and like pool and stuff. And I'll wait for my invite
It's
over
pretty
the coming
nice.
weeks. There you go. There you go. That's awesome. So definitely very neat on that side in terms of how you see the future. And I kind of chuckle because when you say like a lot of foresters like, no, this will never be the world. This will never happen. At times, I feel like it's coming full circle to the start of our conversation where you're like, oh, I've interviewed people to see what the life of the forester is and it resonates with me. But part of the, maybe if we think of it, the fundamental DNA of a forester is like you like to get out to the bush and not talk to anybody, maybe you and your dog or maybe one other person, out there. So when you kind of try and sell, hey, is it really about doing work remotely more efficiently versus, wait, you're taking away why I actually became a forester in the first place? Something to unpack downstream on another call. So as we look to wind down, great conversation. Love getting your thoughts. I know when I thought back to the last time, I think we had m seen each other in person, and I could have this wrong, but it was definitely, at least in my memory, pre-COVID, and it might even have been a Tectera event in the mountains. And where that's what I remembered literally sitting beside you, and we were chatting. I think it was the last 60 geo days that you were doing some stuff there. So certainly time has flown. But when we think about what you're doing today, if folks want to learn more about Carson Integrated, the services, the products, other things that you do, what's the best way for folks to get a hold of you?
I would say probably email. Which is just Lorne, so LORNE at carsonintegrated.com. And that's probably the best way, but if they go onto our website, they'll find a phone number and that type of thing. So I'm always happy for people to just call and chat. And even if you want to just call and talk about ideas or that type of thing, I'm always happy to do that. I love just getting together and brainstorming with people. Like we do a lot of that. Matter of fact, next week I'm sitting down with one of our would maybe be a competitor of ours, but we collaborate on lots of things. And I find that those types of conversations are the best types of conversations. So I'm always happy to do those types of things. Yeah.
Absolutely. So there you go, folks. If you want to get a hold of Lauren, best ways, email lauren@carsonintegrated.com. And that was your chance, my friend. I was trying to give you an out so you can throw your wife partner's email out there and let everyone kind of hit her inbox and you could just kind of sit there and laugh. But then I'd never get invited to the camp because she'd probably say, like, no, we're not having
That's
that.
right.
That
Yeah, he's
digital
not
forester
allowed.
guy, he's not allowed anymore. So, well, hey man, it was great catching up with you, chatting with you. Really appreciate you carving out some time to talk to me on this podcast. Really enjoyed hearing the journey, where you are today, and where you, how you see the future unfolding. So, thanks so much for your time, and looking forward to seeing you in real life over the coming weeks, months. Definitely this year, probably.
Yeah, me too. Thank you very much. This was great. I enjoyed it.
Awesome. All the best.